The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press News, Religion News Service, and U.S. News and World Report. Our first article was published by the Associated Press News on March the 10th and written by Emilio Morinati, entitled, A Religious Procession in Barcelona Celebrates Rain During a Severe Drought in Northeast Spain. Barcelona. A religious procession in downtown Barcelona celebrated the appearance of long-awaited rain after 9 days of praying for relief from a severe drought. Around 100 local people took part in the Catholic ceremony on a rainy Saturday evening. They carried the figure of the Holy Christ of the Blood, winding their way through the city's old town for 2 hours, led by Archbishop Joan Josep Omella. There are a few of us, but it's okay, Omella said inside the Santa Maria del Pai, a 15th-century Gothic church, just before leaving, while outside the rain poured down. Last month, officials in Spain's northeast region of Catalonia, whose main city is Barcelona, declared a drought emergency. Reservoirs serving 6 million people were at less than 16% of their capacity, a historic low that sowed alarm among local people. The last time the figure of the Holy Christ, depicting Jesus on the cross, had left the chapel of San Miguel to help fight drought was 1945. At one point during the procession, the figure was draped in transparent plastic to keep the rain off. Next, an article published by the Religion News Service on March 14, written by Bob Smetana, entitled, American Bible Society to Shutter $60 Million Faith and Liberty Discovery Center. A $60 million museum that showcased the Bible's role in American history will shut down less than 3 years after it opened. The American Bible Society, or ABS, announced on March 13 it will close the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center, also known as FLDC, in Philadelphia on April 1. The 40,000-square-foot museum, which cost a reported $60 million to build, opened in May 2021 in the Wells Fargo building on Independence Mall. Leaders at the ABS had hoped the center, which was designed for sharing the importance of the impact of Scripture on the development of the United States, would draw 250,000 visitors a year, the Philly Voice reported in 2018 when the project was first made public. We want the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center to be a place that unites people, shows how faith has always played a role in our nation, and helps visitors consider what difference faith can make in our lives today, Rory Peterson, then ABS president, said in 2018. The ABS cited the COVID-19 pandemic and other factors impacting sustainability in announcing the decision to close the center. The nonprofit did not immediately respond to questions about the costs of running the center or the number of staffers being laid off. The FLDC, as conceived, was a wonderfully innovative idea. Jennifer Holleran, who became president of ABS this month, told staff in an email, which was obtained by Ministry Watch, a Christian nonprofit watchdog group. That idea came with big possibilities and requirements to allow it to be functional in the long run. Unfortunately, despite the valiant efforts of our FLDC leadership and team, we have not been able to achieve the long-term sustainability that an experience like that needs to be successful. The center, which includes exhibits titled The Freedom of Faith, The Spirit of Liberty, and Struggling Toward Justice, will remain open to the public until March 28. And tickets purchased for visits after that day will be refunded. Rob Wunderling, executive director of FLDC, said he was proud of the work done by the center staff. It has been an honor to serve the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center and witness the many ways it has spurred inspiration, engagement, and personal discovery over the years at the heart of Independence Mall, said Wunderling. Founded in 1816, the ABS funds Bible translation and distribution and creates Bible resources so all people may experience its life-changing message, according to the nonprofit's website. The group, which sold its New York home in 2014 and relocated to Philadelphia, has experienced significant leadership churn over the past decade. In 2014, then-President Doug Birdsall was fired after 6 months on the job. He was succeeded by President Roy Peterson, who retired in 2019. Peterson's successor was removed after 2 years. Several interim leaders were appointed to lead the ABS before Halloran was named president earlier this year. A number of staffers quit the ABS in 2018, protesting new rules on sex and marriage. About 30 staffers were laid off last year, part of a fundamental change to the group's model, according to Christianity Today magazine. ABS has long been one of the most fiscally successful religious charities in the country, with an internal revenue of more than $100 million and more than $600 million in investments, according to its 2022 financial disclosures, the latest available. However, questions have continued about the effectiveness of its management and ministry model. Forbes magazine once described the ABS as a terrific example of how a nonprofit shouldn't operate. Halloran told Christianity Today magazine earlier this year that the group's board and senior leaders have made great progress in refocusing the organization around its historic vision and mission. American Bible Society is well positioned to come alongside the global church and helping people understand the Word, grow deep roots, and truly become hearers and doers of the Word that produced fruit, said Halloran, the first female president of the organization when her new role was announced. I'm excited to bring a fresh perspective to leading this historic organization as it continues to adapt to cultural and technological trends that create significant new challenges and thrilling opportunities. In a statement announcing the FLDC closing, Halloran said the center had served as a place of exceptional learning and inspiration, and that ABS leaders look forward to reimagining what the future of content could look like through a publicly accessible, digitized format. We're tremendously grateful for our local Philadelphia partners, for those who have contributed to its vision, and for the FLDC staff who have invested their hearts into serving every person who has walked through the doors, Halloran said. Now an article published by the U.S. News and World Report on March 8, entitled "Sex Abuse Survivors Dispute Southern Baptist Leadership and Say Federal Investigation is Ongoing." The status of a federal investigation into a leading Southern Baptist agency's handling of sexual abuse is unclear. But this much is clear. Survivors of abuse and their advocates remain deeply skeptical of leaders' intentions to address the scandal in the nation's largest Protestant denomination. Recent events have deepened that distrust. After the Southern Baptist Convention's executive committee said Wednesday that the committee was no longer under federal investigation over its handling of sexual abuse in the church, several survivors and advocates say they've learned directly from Department of Justice officials that no part of the investigation has finished. Further clouding the issue was an ambiguous phrase from the denomination's official news service. Legal counsel for the SBC has since confirmed that the investigation into the SBC as a whole remains open and ongoing, said an article in Baptist Press. While it was long known that other SBC entities were also under investigation, including seminaries and mission agencies, the phrase as a whole appeared to advocates to include the executive committee and to represent a backtracking from the earlier statement. Executive committee spokesperson John Wilkes said Thursday that the Baptist Press article provided added clarification, but did not represent a change in the committee's previous statement. The entity in the best position to clear things up, the DOG itself, has not returned multiple queries from the Associated Press seeking comment on the reports. The department typically does not comment publicly on pending investigations. But survivors and advocates say they've been in touch with federal investigators and been told the broad investigation continues. DOJ officials have confirmed to me this investigation is not closed, said Rachel Denhollander, an attorney and advocate for abuse survivors, on X. She said her understanding is that no portion of the investigation, including that involving the executive committee, has been closed. Survivor and advocate Jennifer Lyell posted on Thursday, "I was personally and proactively contacted by one of the primary DOJ agents leading this investigation to inform me of the erroneous statement made by the EC regarding the state of the investigation and to reiterate their investigation is ongoing." In August 2022, the denomination acknowledged that the DOJ was investigating the handling of sexual abuse by several of its agencies, including seminaries, mission agencies, and the executive committee, which manages day-to-day business for the convention. On Wednesday, the executive committee's interim president, Jonathan Howe, said that committee's counsel was informed February 29 by the DOJ that there is no further action to be taken in the probe, though he did not address the status of the investigation into any of the other SBC entities. The work of abuse reform can and should continue, regardless of the ultimate outcome of the investigation, Denhollander said. However, what has transpired in the past 24 hours highlights again why this work must be undertaken by an independent organization, governed and staffed by qualified experts in the field of abuse reform and institutional transformation, in order to be both effective and credible. The SBC has faced a reckoning over its handling of sexual abuse since a 2019 report by the Houston Chronicle and San Antonio Express News, documenting hundreds of abuse cases in Southern Baptist churches. That led to a 2022 independent consultants report saying top SBC leaders responded to abuse survivors with resistance, stonewalling, and even outright hostility. The executive committee has continued to struggle to respond to the issue, including hearing of plans for an independent commission to oversee a public list of abusive clergy. But advocates were frustrated that the commission was announced while Baptist officials still hadn't secured funding for it. Bruce Frank, a North Carolina pastor who chaired the Southern Baptist initial task force responding to sexual abuse, said the survivor's wariness is understandable. "There's been a lot of progress since 2019, particularly at the local and state level. A lot of training," said Frank, whose task force operated from 2021 to 2022. And recommended reforms that another task force is now overseeing. At the time, he said, "If I was a survivor, yeah, you have every reason to be skeptical, because at the national level, there's been some unnecessary obstacles. Our standard shouldn't be what's a federal crime. Our standard should be, what's the Christ-like way to protect the sheep and deal with the wolves, said Frank, pastor of Biltmore Church, which has served several locations in western North Carolina. Our last article was written by Yonat Shimron and published by the Religion News Service on March 8, entitled, A New Memoir Examines How to Reclaim Faith After a Bipolar Diagnosis. In 2011, when she was 18 years old, Anna Gosmarian was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. As an evangelical, Gosmarian attended church regularly, was active in her youth group, and went to a Southern Baptist high school. This was a prescription for frustration and anguish. In her new book, Devout, A Memoir of Doubt, Gosmarian lays bare how inadequately the church and her church-approved therapist treated her condition, and how she struggled to find another way. Fighting near-constant thoughts of suicide and long depressive episodes, Gosmarian had to leave the church behind to begin to heal. But she never gave up on her faith. Her book offers penetrating insight into the flawed theology around mental health in many evangelical settings, and how they might recover a more affirming and compassionate way of attending to people with mental illness. At its heart, it is an intimate and candid look at the dark night of the soul, and how Gosmarian was able to reanimate her faith through doubt, questioning, and lament, qualities her church tradition assiduously denied. RNS spoke to Gosmarian, who lives in Durham, North Carolina, about how she copes and how she's been able to find stability through medication, therapy, a loving husband, and a baby daughter, as well as her faith. You write compellingly about how evangelical churches deal with mental illness. What were the first messages you got there? So when I was growing up, there was a period where I needed to go to therapy. This was prior to my diagnosis. And church leaders sent me to a Christian counselor, and they were strictly biblically based. And so everything they said was in the Bible. There was no psychology at all. I grew up and saw friends that died by suicide. I remember preachers preaching about Rick Warren's son who died by suicide and saying it was an unforgivable sin and he was going to go to hell. I also went to a Southern Baptist high school. And I remember in my English class one day, the teacher mentioned that people who die by suicide go to hell. So that was the common message I got everywhere. I was someone who always felt like there was something wrong with me because of how much anxiety I had. I was anxious about everything. And I remember my high school pastor saying, "Don't be anxious." But everything made me spiral out of control. And I just thought it was a lack of faith. And so I put everything, like all of my effort, into reading my Bible, into writing, into praying, waiting for my anxiety to go away, and it never did. Would you recommend Christian therapist or pastoral counseling to people of faith who are struggling with mental illness? The reason I thought that was because I was really afraid of psychology, and I was afraid of modern science because I'd been taught to be skeptical of those things. I thought if I went to a regular therapist that had no religious background, they would make me focus more on myself. In my mind, focusing more on myself, being more aware of myself, that was considered selfish, which was also deemed a sin. So any self-improvement or work I viewed as selfish. And the problem was that the therapist I was seeing did not take mental illness seriously. They thought it could be cured by therapy and by reading the Bible. When I was older, I did go to a Christian therapist who did have a medical degree, and for me, that worked really well. So what would you say to people who are struggling with mental illness and want to hold on to their faith? One of the things that blows my mind is how evangelicals have distorted Scripture, basically to mean that living your life only means experiencing happy emotion. And I don't know how we got to this point, because if you look throughout Scripture, there are many people in the Bible that are filled with agony, that are filled with hopelessness. And God is still present through all of those things. When I was in college, I started studying Lamentations. I never heard a pastor even mention Lamentations. It's one of those books that everyone overlooks. I don't understand how we can read the Bible and not support those that are mentally ill, because even Jesus was depressed. And in my opinion, there were moments in Jesus' life that he was hopeless and questioned God. Understanding and looking at Jesus' life, at the agony and frustration of people in the Bible, was really helpful for me, because those were things that were just never talked about. So I think for people that are wanting to be Christians and are mentally ill, I think Christianity is a safe place to come. And if you look at the people that are deemed the most faithful, those people also have immense doubt and immense suffering. And those do not disqualify you from living a faith. And I think the deeper the faith you have, the more that those things come to the surface. In your book, you describe how at one point you set your prayer journals on fire. Explain why you did that. I think I didn't understand the purpose of prayer. I saw it as this thing where I basically apologized to God for everything I'd done wrong. And because of my religious guilt, I constantly just wrote down my sins. I viewed God as someone I needed to please and that I constantly needed to make things up for. That's how I viewed prayer. It wasn't a conversation. It wasn't a relationship. It was more driven by fear. And my journals were basically recalling memories, recalling sins, all the shame and guilt I felt. I realized it wasn't helpful, and it wasn't the way I wanted to view God at the time. I still struggle with prayer. I still struggle with what I think about prayer, because for so many years, my prayer was to be healed, and that was never answered. And I think having a life of prayer, you have to accept the uncertainty and accept what you don't know and live in that space. The faith is not about certainty. Letting go of that control is really difficult. Would you say that writing was the route back to practicing your faith? I think so. I grew up with a view of men as the leaders and women as submissive and quiet. And the problem for me was I was never quiet. I always had a lot of opinions, and I thought there was something wrong with me for having all those things. And I constantly felt myself wanting to be smaller, wanting to take up less space. I thought that is what it meant to be a woman, especially as a Christian. Writing gave me a voice, and it gave me a space to think for myself and not just trust in what other people told me. For so long, I don't feel like I was given the space to have a voice. I was just told what to believe. And if I had questions or doubts, I was not supposed to express them. So for me, writing was kind of like a conversation with God. Even writing the book, it felt like there was something really intimate about just my editor and me reading the material and feeling like God was there. So I do think that writing definitely enabled me to experience God in a different way. You write about your experiences with ketamine, a powerful sedative, and how it has helped you. Is it still helping you? The hardest thing about writing a memoir is that it only captures a moment in life in your time. After I had my daughter, my mental health kind of collapsed. And it was very difficult for me to work on the book because I felt like a fraud for writing this book about mental health and recovery and grappling with faith, because I was living with those things in real time. I struggle with postpartum depression. And because I didn't have ketamine, During pregnancy, I did not have the tolerance built up. The last 2 years have been really hard, and I was resistant to a lot of medications. It was a reminder to me that my symptoms are always going to be there. It's tempting to believe there's an end point in which everything is under control. You find the right medication, and everything is solved. Prior to having my daughter, there was a 3-year period where I was doing ketamine when everything in my life felt stable. Then, when I had my daughter, everything was ripped apart, and I actually ended up going to a treatment facility. And when I was there, I remember being so discouraged and scared about my book coming out, because who am I to talk about all this stuff when I'm living this in real time? And while I was there, I met many people with religious trauma who were grappling with faith and mental illness. For me, that was a reminder of who the book is for. Even if it did not help me get to a more stable place, it might help other people. For me, that's worth it. A lot of people, when they encounter a crisis of faith or feel abused by the church, they leave religion altogether. You didn't do that. Why? It was really difficult because there are moments where I think, would it be easier if I walked away? I'm friends with a lot of people that are not Christians, and they ask me, this religion has hurt you in so many ways. How can you keep going back to it? And what comfort is it providing for your life? That is something I really struggle with because I don't think faith is really about comfort. And I don't think that it is giving me more contentment. I think, if anything, it's making my life harder. So I continue to struggle with that. And looking at American Christianity, we've gone off the rails. And it's hard for me to call myself a Christian because of that. But I feel like I can't distance myself from the life of Christ and the way he loved people so radically. And that is why I keep coming back. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.